Captain James Drake paced the bridge while he waited for the aliens to respond to his offer. An hour had passed since he'd powered down his plasma engines and hailed the room fleet. There had been no response since then, but the aliens had been busy. Even as Blackbeard sat, motionless in space, the two biggest room ships, both sloops of war, aimed their long pointed snouts directly at Blackbeard's side, ready to ram her should she attempt to flee. The other five room ships, small destroyer-like craft and mid-range patrol boats, circled Blackbeard warily. Sensors detected room pulse cannon and serpentines warming up. Drake's computers picked up a flurry of encrypted subspace messages outbound from one of the sloops, which he took as the alien flagship. "What the devil is taking them so long?" he asked, stopping in front of the viewscreen, as if staring at it would materialize the room general.
"Is that a question, sir, or are you simply musing to yourself?"
Nib Pym asked. Nib Pym was a room himself, and Drake's pilot. He'd been the one to speak to the alien general when Blackbeard arrived in the system. Blackbeard was not hostile, Nib Pym promised. Was no longer even an Albion warship. She'd mutinied from the Royal Navy, had overhauled her systems in the San Pablo spaceyards, and had been on the run ever since. They had valuable cargo to share with the Hroom, something that might change the course of the war.
"I was musing," Drake said. "But if you have an answer, go ahead and share it."
"Humans are notoriously deceptive," Nib Pym said. "The Hroom naturally suspect that you are lying."
"We're only one ship pilot. We're practically helpless."
"That is why they suspect a trap. It seems an obvious ruse. That they cannot see how you would spring the trap is all the more alarming."
"Sir," Commander Tolvern said, looking up from her console, "the Hroom are hailing us." Drake let out his breath, relieved that the waiting was over.
"Put them on."
"The caller has identified himself as General Mose Driz," she said. "Would you like to take the call in the war room?"
Mose Driz. That was not good news. The general had been leading Empire forces during the Battle of Kif Lagoon. His plodding maneuvers had allowed Drake to split his own fleet in two, sending Captain Rutherford through the asteroid belt and then pinning the general's forces until Admiral Malthorn arrived on Dreadnought. Drake was surprised to hear that the Hroom general was not only still alive, but commanding a new fleet. Drake looked around the bridge. His crew was jumpy, nervous, especially the sub-pilot, Henny Cap, who rubbed at the tattooed lions on her right forearm and muttered to herself. Cap was one of the former prisoners freed in the mutiny. She would know nothing about Mose Driz or the Battle of Kif Lagoon. Maybe that was for the better. He didn't need her any more anxious about the aliens. But taking the call in the war room would send the wrong signal, indicating that he had something to hide from his crew. "I'll take it here," he said. "Put him on."
Tolvern connected the call. The view of space and the lurking alien warships vanished, replaced by a glimpse of the bridge of a Hroom sloop of war. A tall Hroom looked back at him through his wide, liquid eyes. He wore a white toga-style tunic with a gold sunburst on the chest, indicating his rank as general. A circlet of black iron ringed his smooth head, a coronet indicating blood kinship with the Empress, if Drake remembered correctly. Drake turned to his pilot.
"Tell him again that we have peaceful intentions, that we have something to give him that might end the war."
"You can tell me yourself, Captain Drake," Mose Driz said. "I speak and understand your language."
His accent was thick, and "your" became stretched, elongated into "your." But there was something else that caught Drake's attention. The light was low and red on the alien bridge, and he hadn't immediately taken note of the general's skin color. He noticed it now, and he wasn't the only one. Cap muttered a curse, and Tolvern frowned deeply and typed in a quick message that blinked on Drake's console. He knew without glancing down what she was going to warn him about. General Mose Driz was a sugar eater. A Hroom's natural skin tone was reddish-violet, or more rarely, a deep bruised purple. But long exposure to sugar bleached out the natural pigments.
The Froom staring back from the alien bridge was so pale and pink he must have been eating sugar for years. What would the general say if he knew what Drake was carrying in his science lab?
"Where is the rest of your fleet?" Mosdriz asked.
"I don't have a fleet. This ship is alone. We do not fly the Albion Lions. We are renegades."
"You have flown this deeply into the Empire alone?"
"Not alone," Drake confessed. He wasn't sure how much the Froom already knew, and thought it best not to lie. "I was traveling with a pirate frigate named Orient Tiger, smuggling Tyrillium, and we came briefly to the aid of a Royal Navy cruiser that was under attack by an unknown alien race. Since then we have traveled alone, yes."
"I think you are lying. Either some or all of this is false."
"It isn't, I assure you."
"You are wearing the uniform of the Royal Navy of the Kingdom of Albion. Yet you claim to be... what word did you use? A renegade. This is an outlaw, yes? A traitor?"
"I am not a traitor to Albion. Only an enemy of Lord Admiral Malthorn, who I believe has unjustly broken the treaty between our two nations."
"It is unjust. You are correct in that," Mosdriz said. "You forced this treaty on us under unequal terms. But to break it so soon is no surprise. We have come to expect treachery from Albion. A false treaty, lies while you position your forces for a new campaign. And this is why you have come, yes? To draw my attention while your navy attacks us elsewhere."
"No," Drake said. "I told you."
"You claim to possess something that will end the war. What is it?"
Drake hesitated. He'd meant to explain what he had, and then gain assurances that he'd be allowed to depart in peace once he sent it over. A sugar antidote to end the addiction crippling the Froom Empire. Together with the antidote seized from Malthorn's estate, Drake would send over Science Officer Brockett's notes about how to replicate the formula. His duty would be done. Let the Froom make of the antidote what they wished. But this Froom was an eater, and most eaters did not want to be freed of their addiction. Mosdriz would probably destroy the antidote, and that would be the end of it. "Who is your commanding officer?" Drake asked. The general blinked his large, wet eyes.
"Why do you ask?"
"I want to speak with him before I hand over what I've brought. Who is he?"
"I will not tell you."
That was typical for a Froom. Rather than lie, they would refuse to answer when they didn't want to share information. Drake respected that, since he preferred the truth himself. "I can't give this to you, General. We fought at Kiflagoon."
"Yes, I know. You were the Albion general."
"More or less. I was the flag officer until Dreadnought arrived. Given our history, I would prefer to speak to another Froom."
"You do not respect me because we fought and you defeated me. Do I understand you correctly?"
"No, that isn't it at all," Drake said. He thought the meaning had been clear enough. "But you might harbor certain thoughts."
"Harbor? A spaceport? I do not understand."
"No. Harbor is a metaphor, a comparison. You might be holding certain thoughts of revenge. That is all I mean. I would rather talk to someone I didn't fight." Fight and defeat, that went without saying. Drake wasn't being entirely honest. This was mostly about the general's sugar addiction. But there was some truth in it, a whiff anyway.
"You mean that revenge is on my mind?"
Mosdriz sounded thoughtful, if Drake was interpreting his tone correctly.
"The battle is over. My anger has..."
He seemed to be searching for a word, then made a gesture with his long fingers like poof, vanished, dissipated. "All the same, can you tell me how to contact your superior officer? I'd like to speak with him if I can."
"I have no superior officer, Captain Drake. I am the military leader of all the forces still commanded by the Empress.
What do you mean, still commanded? Is it true there's a civil war in the Empire?
Mos Driz didn't answer the question.
You claim you have brought me something. You will give it to me, or I will assume deception and attack. This is not a negotiation.
At least let me give it to you directly. Once you have it, its safekeeping will be in your hands, not mine. Come over to my ship. I'll show you what I have, and how it may be used.
I will not do that. I do not trust you, James Drake, and I do not trust my safety on board your ship.
I give you my word, as an officer and a gentleman.
That does not mean anything to me. Your customs as to what is honest and what is not are so.
Mos Driz said something in Hroom, and Drake looked to his pilot. What did he say?
There's no exact translation, Nib Pim said, but it means something like arcane or inscrutable, an attempt to understand something that cannot be explained. And I do not believe the word of an officer or gentleman translates into Hroom either, not its direct meaning.
You tell him. Explain that I fully meant what I said.
Nib Pim unfolded his 7-foot height and came over to where Drake sat in the captain's chair. He looked up at the screen and spoke in his strange tongue, with its whistles and hoots. The general responded in shorter phrases.
He says I have been corrupted,
Nib Pim told Drake.
He does not trust me either.
No, I do not, Mos Driz said. James Drake, you will give me this object, or you will not be allowed to leave.
I'll give it to you, Drake said, but I must give it to you in person. If you won't come here, I will travel to your ship with my pilot and my science officer, if you can promise in turn that we won't be harmed or detained.
I will not make such a promise.
Why not? Surely you could agree to a parley, a truce.
What if you behave with treachery?
The general asked.
What if you are lying about bringing something, and it is some other trick or game?
Very well. So long as I behave honorably, will you promise not to harm or detain me, my ship, or any of my crew?
General Mos Driz stared back for several long seconds, as if puzzling through the offer and parsing it for potential lies.
Yes, he said at last. That is a condition I will agree to.
They discussed the logistics of the meeting, then Drake ended the call. The general, with his pale, sugar-eating skin, disappeared, replaced by a view of the circling Hroom warships, framed by a bright, unflickering mantle of stars. Out here in deep void, his safest option would be to turn around and run for his life, but he had traveled too far for that now. Smythe, he said to the tech officer, whose job had been to watch his instruments for unusual Hroom activity during the meeting. Call the lab. Tell Brockett we're leaving in 15 minutes. Pilot, he added to Nib Pim, you feel comfortable visiting the Hroom ship? Nib Pim nodded solemnly.
Yes, sir.
Drake now turned to Tolvern. That leaves you with the bridge, Commander.
You don't think the General will try anything while you're away, do you?
She asked. I wouldn't expect trouble, no. But if there is, I'm counting on you to handle it.
Yes, sir.
Good. Drake put a hand to his sidearm. I guess I'll be leaving this behind. His fingers touched the captain's bars on his uniform, and he sighed. And I suppose that wearing the red and black onto their ship is an unnecessary provocation. He eyed Tolvern. The general seemed agitated by the uniforms. It is an unnecessary provocation. Do you mind terribly if I ask you to change out of your uniform, in case we need to pull you up on the viewscreen while I'm over there?
No, sir, I figured as much. With your permission, I'll go change my clothes now.
Drake nodded.
Dismissed.
He watched her go and sighed again. He and Tolvern were the only two left on the bridge who still wore their Royal Navy uniforms.
Some of the mutineers had been freed prisoners and had never worn uniforms to begin with, while the rest had either swapped their uniforms for civilian dress in the mining colony where they'd put in for repairs, or even earlier in the San Pablo yards. After San Pablo, their ship had been so altered that she was no longer a Punisher-class cruiser, and she no longer displayed the Albion Lions. Instead, above the bridge, they'd welded plating taken from a pirate frigate that boasted the ominous skull and crossed sabers. Drake had rechristened her Starship Blackbeard. Drake meant the name ironically, still bitter at the circumstances that had driven him from the Navy, but it was no surprise when the name stuck. Half the crew were pirates to begin with. The other half had become pirates. He told himself this as he retreated to his quarters to change out of his uniform. But when he was dressed in simple trousers with a gray pullover shirt, he stared in the bathroom mirror, feeling morose. He was about to meet his former enemy, of whom General and Lord, and he wasn't even in uniform. Someone knocked on the door. It was Commander Tulvern. She held clothing.
"This is for you, Captain."
She gave him a sleeveless vest, tan canvas with leather trim, brass buttons, and leather loops to hook them with. It reminded Drake of one of his father's riding jackets, but with old Earth maritime flair. "Where did you get this?"
"I bought it when we put in for repairs, grabbed your jacket from the laundry, and had this vest tailored to fit."
"But why?" She took it back and started putting it on him.
"I'll show you."
"I really don't think..."
"James, enough of that. For once, don't be so stubborn."
He stopped at her use of his given name, and let her put it on him and button it up. She left the top two buttons unlooped, then led him into the bathroom where he could see himself in the mirror. He wasn't entirely satisfied. It did not replace his smart red military jacket trimmed with black, but it did make him look more dignified, like a sea captain, perhaps, prosperous and of good breeding. Tulvern had lingered behind while he studied himself in the mirror, and now she came into the bathroom, holding his captain's bars, which she pinned to his collar.
"Look at you now. Don't you feel better?"
"Say it that way and I sound vain."
"I wouldn't say vain, but you're proud. You know your station in life, and you are determined to maintain it."
"Such insight into my soul," he said lightly. Tulvern raised an eyebrow.
"Give me a little bit of credit. You've been like this since you were a boy. I grew up on your father's estate, remember? I watched you riding by with your hounds and your gun. My mother used to comment when you rode past that this was what a young man of good breeding looked like."
She straightened his jacket.
"And now you look a proper gentleman again."
"How much did this cost? I should reimburse you."
"Don't be ridiculous. It's a gift. Anyway, I was spending some of my hard-won loot and thought I'd buy myself some new clothes. I've been waiting for the right moment to take off the uniform."
She shrugged.
"I figured I may as well get you something, too. I knew it wouldn't be easy for you, but a nice captain's jacket would help."
"Thank you, Jess," he said. "That was very thoughtful of you." Drake looked her over, noticing now that she was wearing finely cut civilian trousers tucked into knee-high black boots, with a new belt around her slender waist. She had a short jacket over a trim, long-sleeved shirt. "Very nice," he said. "That's a becoming look for you." Tulvern blushed and looked away. She touched the comlink at her ear.
"Hey, Brockett, are you ready?" "Yeah?" "Then get yourself to the pod. The captain will be there in 2 minutes."
She ended the call and looked back at Drake.
"Ready, sir?"
He straightened his jacket, felt the empty spot where his sidearm should be. "As ready as can be. It's time for me to meet these Froom and give them the gift that will cement my position as a traitor." Chapter 2. Jane's cool computer voice came into the pod.
20 seconds to launch. Prepare for rapid acceleration."
The yellow light pulsed above the door, and Drake checked his restraints out of habit. Nib Pym sat in his oversized chair, an extra belt across his chest, looking through the window and into the void. Brockett waited with his eyes closed, his lips moving as he counted down to himself.
10 seconds, Jane said.
"King's balls," Brockett said.
A sloop of war. Well...
Remain calm. This is no time to get agitated, Drake told him.
5 seconds.
Drake closed his eyes. For a moment, he was back in orbit around Albion, ready to be launched toward the prison ship that would take him to the Helium-3 mines, where he'd been sentenced to 2 years of hard labor. False charges, at a joke of a court-martial. He now knew that Admiral Malthorn had framed him, and since then the villain had murdered Drake's sister and imprisoned his parents. As soon as he was finished here, he was on his way back to Albion to free them. A hiss, a pop, and then pressure on his chest as they catapulted through space. Drake looked through the window, but saw only the stars, thousands of pinpricks of light in a vast curtain across the sky. Then a pair of glittering green ships came into view, and soon the pod was hurtling toward one of them, which had put out a spacehook, a net on the end of a long arm. How easy would it be for General Mose Driz to retract the hook, to move it slightly, and let the pod fly past, destroy Blackbeard, while Drake sailed away toward nothing? The oxygen would run out in a few hours, and then the pod would be a floating coffin, flying forever through the endless void. The net caught them, and the arm brought them in. A few minutes later, in the cargo bay, the airlock popped open and let them out. The light was dim and red, and the air hot and jungle thick. It had to be 90 degrees. By the time he'd taken 2 breaths, the sweat was beading on his forehead and trickling down his ribs. Brockett panted as he lugged out a cooler containing the vials of antidote. He unzipped his jacket. Nib Pym seemed comfortable enough. He took a deep breath through his narrow nostrils and let it out through his mouth. 3 tall hoom stood about 10 paces away, next to a stack of what looked like live torpedoes, near a wall of crates stamped with the stylized Y of the York Company, what could only be sugar. There must be 20 tons of the stuff in the cargo bay. An Empire warship carrying the poison that had brought Hroom civilization to its knees. And to complete the irony, the torpedoes were unguarded, but 2 red-skinned Hroom with long buzzing shock spears guarded the sugar. Drake ignored the guards and studied the 3 Hroom standing side by side. 2 wore mottled green cloaks over their tunics that matched the exterior color of their warship. The 3rd wore a white toga with a sunburst on the chest and an iron ring around his forehead, the general. With the toga and his proud regal bearing, he seemed to Drake like a Hroom Caesar. Yet of all the Hroom in the cargo bay, he was the only one with the pale skin of an eater. More curious still. Drake approached cautiously, keeping his hands clasped as Nib Pym had instructed. It was a Hroom sign of peaceful intent.
"Captain James Drake," Mose Driz said. "Is that you? I am not very good at telling human faces apart. Let me hear your voice."
"Yes, it's me, General. I meant what I said. I have a gift for you, and perhaps some information to share as well."
Mose Driz didn't say anything. He and Drake stood, eyeing each other, until Brockett began to clear his throat and shift about nervously.
"Where did you learn English?"
Drake asked to cut the silence.
"I would rather not answer that."
"It is a friendly question. I'm just curious."
"Captain James Drake, we are enemies, and I do not wish to establish a..."
He said something to Nib Pym. "Rapport," Nib Pym told the general.
"Yes, rapport,"
Mose Driz said again to Drake.
"We are enemies, and we should both remember that."
"I am not your foe," Drake said. "My navy fought a war against your navy. We were both soldiers following orders. That doesn't make us enemies now."
"Did your orders include the atomic bombardment of Hroom cities on San Pablo?"
"That wasn't me. By the time that happened, I'd been declared a traitor and was fleeing for my life with my ship and crew. My last naval engagement was the battle at Ypres 3. Well before the current round of hostilities commenced."
"I see. Then you are merely responsible for the death of thousands, not hundreds of thousands, of my people, and the enslavement of millions. I see what you mean. How could we possibly be enemies?
The general might not understand lying and deception very well, but he had mastered sarcasm. It's the enslavement of your people that brings me here. I propose to free them. A gesture of peace from my people to yours.
And how would you do that? Outlaw slavery in Albion territory? Are you king now that you could do such a thing? And has your parliament been abolished?
Mos Driz made a humming sound when Drake tried to interrupt.
Even if such a thing were possible, you understand that the problem is not slavery, yes? Some of our own worlds allow people to be sold into bondage, depending on local custom and religion.
I'm not talking about the laws, Drake said. Ladino and New Dutch colonies are slaves too, some of them human. I don't know if you could ever stamp it out entirely. But it isn't human law that has left millions of whom in bondage. Mos Driz glanced at the stacked crates with the York Company logo on them, to the sugar. His long tongue darted out and ran over his lips. It was such a human gesture that Drake could almost read his mind. He felt sorry for the room. Even now, when he had the most reason to be angry, the general had looked to the crates of sugar, grown, harvested, and refined by slaves on vast estates like Lord Malthorn's on Hot Barsa. The poisonous substance literally grown over the top of an ancient Hroom civilization. Here was the general, supreme military leader of the Hroom Empire. Yet he was thinking about how long until he could eat sugar again. Now he looked to the cooler Brockett had brought over. It sat at the science officer's feet. The general said something in Hroom. Nib Pim stiffened.
Captain, he warned.
The guards with the shock spears rushed in. Drake reached for his sidearm, but of course he wasn't carrying it. One of the guards jabbed Nib Pim and Brockett with the two-pronged spear, and they collapsed to the ground, groaning. Drake ducked away from the second room, grabbed the spear by its shaft, and tried to wrench it free. His opponent kept his grip and swung his fist for Drake's head, enjoying his longer reach. The blow caught Drake across the head, and he fell back. He was ducking another spear thrust when something jabbed him in the back. The other Hroom guard. A jolt of electricity stabbed through him. His legs collapsed, and he lay there twitching and unable to feel his body. When he'd recovered, he climbed shakily to his feet and helped up his two companions. More Hroom had materialized from the opposite side of the cargo bay, until there were six guards in all. They held snub-nosed hand cannons, joining the original two with their buzzing spears.
"What are you doing?" Drake demanded.
His skin tingled and burned, and his legs wobbled like they were made of jelly. Sweat poured down his temples from the heat and humidity.
"What is in the box?"
Mos Driz demanded. He and his two adjutants in the green cloaks had not moved from their position.
"A sugar antidote. Why did you attack us?"
What is that? What does that mean? I do not know this word. Antidote. Tell me at once.
Nib Pim translated. The general and his adjutants jabbered together in their high, hooting language. They seemed to grow more agitated by the moment.
It is a cure?
Mos Driz's voice was higher, strained.
How do you mean? Tell me now.
Not a cure. An antidote. Brockett, tell him how it works. Brockett cleared his throat and sputtered, seemingly unable to get the words out. His face was slack, terrified, and his eyes darted to the guards with their shock spears, which were buzzing ominously.
Quit mumbling, Brockett, Drake said. Spit it out.
The science officer found his voice.
It alters your brain chemistry, in the Hroom brain, I mean, so that it releases molecules that bond with sugar and renders it inert. I mean, that is, sugar can't interact with the pleasure center of your brain anymore. There's a vestigial organ the Hroom have that...
Be quiet, the general said. I have heard enough.
But if you'll let me explain...
Brockett,
Drake warned. That is enough. The science officer fell silent. Drake touched a finger to his ear to turn on his comlink, but all he heard was a beep, indicating a failure to connect. The room must be jamming the signal.
"Why did you attack us?"
Drake asked the general.
"What is in the box?"
"I told you already."
"You are lying. Something is in the box. Something treacherous. It is not an antidote to the sugar addiction. Do you think our scientists have not already attempted such a thing, that if it were possible, we would have discovered it already?"
"I give you my word. I am not lying." The room said something to the guards, who approached with the shock spears. They were buzzing louder now, apparently turned to a higher power level. When they motioned for him to move, Drake had no choice but to comply. As he walked with his two companions across the cargo bay floor, he glanced back to see General Mose Driz standing over Brockett's cooler, staring down at it. The Hoom guards pushed them into a holding cell lit with dim red lights. One of the guards hit a button, and three chairs, shaped like wide flat saucers, rose from the floor. The guards shut the door as they retreated to the corridor, leaving Drake and his two companions inside. To Drake's surprise, it was significantly cooler inside and not so humid, and he wiped the sweat away with his sleeve and took a deep breath. He touched his comm link again, a beep followed by static. Nib Pim climbed onto one of the seats and crossed his long, slender legs. He looked resigned. "At least I can breathe again," Brockett said glumly, "although I suspect that we'll soon be shivering. It has to be about 60 degrees in here, wouldn't you think?"
"The temperature is meant to sedate us," Nib Pim said.
Drake remembered the slave galleon from which he'd rescued Nib Pim. The slavers had kept the room in a single berth, cooled to keep their cargo placid between sugar feedings.
"What did the general say?" Drake asked. "Are we prisoners? Is this a room prison cell?"
"I have never been on a room ship," Nib Pim said. "I do not know what a prison cell looks like."
"Yes, I forget. So you have no idea?"
"I am afraid I do have an idea."
There was something odd in Nib Pim's voice.
"This is a prayer room. These seats are meditation stools for praying."
"A prayer room?" Drake said.
"I don't get it," Brockett said. "Are they trying to convert us to their religion or something?"
"No,"
Nib Pim said.
"It is where you make your peace and pray to the God of Death before they execute you."
"What?"
Brockett squeaked.
"Captain, is that true?"
"He is a room," Drake said. "He doesn't lie, as a general rule."
"No, I do not,"
Nib Pim said.
"So we're going to die?"
Brockett said.
"King's balls we are, aren't we?"
"I hope not," Drake said. "For now, let's calm down until we have a better idea of what the room are thinking."
Nib Pim closed his eyes. Praying. Drake hadn't thought him particularly devout. In fact, hadn't he been raised by human missionaries? Surely he wouldn't be praying to the room God of Death. Brockett paced the room.
"My dad owns a candy store."
Drake looked away from studying the room and blinked.
"What?"
"A candy store. You know, the kind where you go as a kid, you put down a tuppence, and the candy man weighs out whorehounds or lemon drops and puts them into a little bag. Or cinnamon bears. I love cinnamon bears."
"I know what a candy store is. How is this relevant?"
"Dad wanted me to take over the store when he got too old to run it. Me, not my brother. My brother has no head for numbers, plus he'd eat up the profits. He's got a sweet tooth that would put a room to shame. Of course, I loved candy too. What kid doesn't?"
"Brockett, for God's sake, is this the time to reminisce about your misspent youth?"
"I wanted to be a scientist. Why, the store wasn't so bad. And now look at me. I'm going to be killed over sugar. Sugar! That's ironic, don't you think? I grew up helping my dad at a candy store. It must be bad karma for all the cavities we gave kids."
"We're not going to be killed over sugar," Drake said.
"Didn't you hear him?"
Brockett asked, pointing at Nib Pim. He sounded almost hysterical now.
"This is a prayer room. You're supposed to pray for your soul while they build the gallows."
Whom don't hang prisoners, Drake said. They prefer beheading.
That doesn't make me feel better. It really doesn't.
Had Tolvern been here, she would have told Brockett to shut his mouth. But Drake was willing to grant the young man a little hysteria. He'd seemed brave enough when invited to join the crew after the attack on Lord Malthorn's estate that put the sugar antidote in Drake's hands. But Hot Barsa was a slave world, and Brockett had been working in Malthorn's labs, developing fast-growing strains of sugar cane. That was the karma that would be inflaming Brockett's conscience, not that nonsense about his father's candy store. Drake climbed onto one of the seats while he waited for Brockett to calm down. It was too big, too high off the ground, and he couldn't fold his legs the way Nib Pym had. But the way it cupped him did provide a certain meditative space. Eventually Brockett joined the other two. They sat without talking, with only the faint hum of the red lights overhead and their own breathing to cut the silence. After about 15 minutes, the door opened and in stepped General Mos Driz. He was alone. His eyes were milky, and his breathing quick, as if he'd recently eaten sugar. Drake rose respectfully to his feet, readying himself at the same time for a hostile move.
"I will never understand humans," Mos Driz said. "When I think they are telling the truth, they are sure to be lying. When I am certain they are lying, it turns out that they have honorable intentions."
"You've inspected the antidote already?" Drake asked.
"Your commander says she will attack my fleet if I do not allow her to communicate with you. I do not know if she is bluffing or not, but I have stopped blocking your communications link. Please tell her that you are not a prisoner, and that I will allow you to leave when you are ready."
"Is this true? We'll be able to leave, all three of us?"
"Of course," Mos Driz said.
Drake touched his ear, and shortly Tolvern was on the comm, demanding answers. He assured her that he was safe and unharmed, and that she should maintain a neutral posture with Blackbeard while he completed the negotiations.
"We have only begun to analyze this so-called cure you've offered," the general said when Drake had ended the call. "But my scientists have read enough of your notes that they do not believe it is a trap or a trick. I am searching for a volunteer to test it. Nearly a third of my crew are sugar eaters. No doubt someone will step forward. Many will resist, of course. They will not give up sugar willingly."
"There are several doses," Brockett said quickly, "and my notes should be self-explanatory. You should be able to replicate it."
Drake chose his words carefully. "When it proves effective, General, will you take it yourself?" Mos Driz licked his lips. He seemed as though he would answer the question, but he didn't. Instead, he said,
"You scientists are clearly superior to ours. Whom have searched for generations to find this cure."
"They weren't my scientists," Drake said. "I only discovered the antidote by accident, and made the choice to share it with the Whom once I'd got my hands on it. I don't know who developed it, or why. Could have been Whom involved. I suspect as much."
"Yet still human in origin," Mos Driz said. "You are scientists, you are engineers, even you are military thinkers, possess a creativity that ours do not. No doubt we did once. Our civilization was vast and complex, and it did not spring from nothing. But now we are emulators. We copy what has been done before."
The Whom paused, his eyes blinking. Some of the cloudiness had begun to fade, and Drake thought the general must have taken a mild dose of sugar, as he didn't seem to be swooning from its effects.
"Why did you give it to me?"
Mos Driz asked.
"You must certainly understand what this means, how it will change the future relations between our peoples."
"I don't think anyone understands the implications," Drake said. "Not fully.
But yes, it will change things, perhaps with great damage to human civilization in this sector. If the Hroom recover their strength, and they prove vengeful...
You did not answer the question, Mosdriz said. Why? You defeated my fleet, you destroyed my strongest warships, and now you are giving me this. It is a weapon. Yes, a weapon.
I don't know why. Conscience. Or perhaps it's our shared enemy. I know Hroom, I understand Hroom. They're civilized people. They can be reasoned with, even befriended and trusted as individuals. Drake nodded in the direction of his pilot, then turned back to the general. But I don't know Apex, and I fear them.
What is that? Mosdriz said. Apex.
Nib Pim said something in Hroom, and the general stiffened.
You know, don't you? Drake said, studying his reaction. You've heard they've returned, that they've attacked Hroom ships.
But did you know that they attacked human vessels, too? Mosdriz didn't answer.
I don't know if your silence means yes or no, Drake said. But it's true. We fought two of their ships, destroying one and chasing off the other.
How did you do that?
Drake smiled.
You're not the only one who hears questions he does not wish to answer.
So you are offering this as a trade. This is what you want in return. Human and Hroom against Apex, against the Predator hunting us both. An alliance.
I can't offer an alliance. I'm a renegade, a declared pirate, and Lord Malthorn is determined to start another war.
He has already started it.
I know, and I can't stop him, Drake said. So I can't offer you an alliance.
That is good, because I cannot offer an alliance either. Neither can the Empress, not at this time. And it is not the war with Albion that prevents it. Though that is a part.
Because there's another war, isn't there? A Hroom civil war. That's what I've heard. Is it true?
There is always a civil war, Mosdriz said. Since humans arrived and gave us sugar, there is always some part or other of the Empire in rebellion. But this time, it is different.
What is happening this time? Drake asked. Mosdriz stood silently for a long moment, looking contemplative. When he finally spoke, he didn't answer the question.
There is something else I can give you in trade.
I didn't ask for trade. You understand that? This is a gift. Perhaps you will remember this down the road, but I give it to you freely.
So you have said.
The Hroom turned his deep, liquid gaze to Brockett.
You are clearly a skilled scientist, and perhaps you can make something more of this than we have. A tissue sample. Can you... How do you say?
He said something to Nib Pim.
He wants to know if you can sequence a genetic code,
Nib Pim said. Of course, Brockett said. I'm a geneticist by trade, and Blackbeard has a great lab, all the tools I need.
What kind of tissue sample? Drake asked.
How do you call them? Apex? Yes, two samples from enemies killed in battle. Our people are working on them, too. But so far, we have made little progress. So if you a scientist thinks he can make something of them, I will share.
Brockett's eyes lit up. I'll sure try. Yeah, this is great. Happy to tell you what I find, too, if the captain will let me.
We'll make of it what we can, Drake told the general. If we find anything useful, we'll let you know.
Very well. I will send you back with the samples. I suppose that is all. You may return to your pod now.
Mosdriz turned as if to go, then hesitated, as if he wanted to say something else.
Yes, General? Drake asked.
Again, silence. Brockett opened his mouth, as if something had just occurred to him about the tissue samples, but Drake lifted a hand to hush him. Let the general think. Let him fill the silence himself.
I should not tell you this, Mosdriz said at last. but these people are my enemies as well as yours.
Apex, Drake asked.
No, not Apex. A Hroom faction. They must not succeed, or their next step will be to destroy me and all Hroom who think as I do.
Succeed in what?
There is a death cult in the Empire Navy,
Mos Driz said.
Worshippers of the Dark Wanderer, the God of Death.
Drake thought back to the temple platform outside Malthorn's estate on Hot Barsa. The Amkar. Yes, I've heard of the God of Death. This is his prayer room, right?
Yes. Then you know he is a jealous god. He preserves those who honor him and destroys those who do not. The Hroom people have dishonored their most important god. This is what the Death Cult says. And they wish to cleanse our worlds. They will put all of the Sugar Eaters to death for a start. Do you know how many millions, how many billions would die? More than Albion has ever killed or could dream of killing.
You could kill all the Eaters, but sugar would still exist, Drake said. Someone would smuggle more in, and it would start all over again.
That is why they will also destroy the Sugar Worlds, Hot Barsa, San Pablo, Antilles, and, of course, the biggest sugar world of them all. It does not grow sugar itself, but it is the heart of the trade and the source of the cult's anger.
Drake stared. You mean Albion?
Yes.
Mos Driz held his gaze.
This is what I offer you in trade, Captain James Drake. A warning. The Death Cult means to destroy Albion. They have assembled a massive fleet of sloops of war and loaded them with fissile material. It is a one-way mission. They do not intend to return. They do not wish to fight your navy or battle your orbital forts. They will aim at your homeworld and bomb it.
Disseminate the antidote, Drake said. That will undercut this cult. They'll have no reason to kill Sugar Eaters, and no cause to attack Albion with a suicide fleet.
It is too late for that. They have already left. They cannot be contacted or recalled. Nobody must know their course, because they must arrive via the most circuitous route possible to lessen the chance that they will be detected by your Royal Navy before they enter the Albion system. But when they arrive, they mean to turn Albion into a radioactive wasteland.
Chapter 3. HMS Vigilant was only an hour from her last jump point and still accelerating when she drew the attention of a hungry star Leviathan. Captain Nigel Rutherford had just gone down for his sleep cycle when they recalled him urgently to the bridge, and by the time he'd thrown on a uniform and rushed to the helm, the Leviathan had homed in on the cruiser's plasma engines and was giving chase. Commander Pittsfield was in the captain's chair, but he sprang to his feet with a look of relief and moved aside for Rutherford to take the helm. The Leviathan stretched across the viewscreen, the body 800 yards long, with ropey tentacles stretching several miles behind it. Violet plasma vented from its nozzle.
"How the devil did this happen?"
Rutherford demanded, glaring at Tech Officer Norris, one of Malthorn's loyalists. Sweeping a system for star Leviathans was routine upon coming out of a jump.
"He says that he looked," Pittsfield said dryly, "but he claims not to have found anything."
"It was lurking in that gas giant," Norris protested. "It must have been dormant. We can't pick them up when they're dormant, you know that."
"Right, of course, it was dormant," Rutherford said sarcastically. "So it popped out of its dormant state and fired up its nozzle just like that."
He narrowed his eyes and glared until Norris looked away.
"This one was awake and lurking. You missed it."
"Sorry, sir."
"Scan its belly. Let's see how hungry it is."
Norris brought the viewscreen to a higher resolution. A closer inspection confirmed that it was in its feeding state. When dormant, a leviathan tucked in all its parts until it looked like a fat, bloated whale. But when it entered its feeding state, it uncoiled until it resembled a monstrous squid, like a kraken from ancient legends. Once Rutherford had been on Dreadnought when Malthorn's battleship fought off one of the monsters. A tentacle had pierced the Tyrillium armor, plunged through two decks, and been hacked off by marines as it groped for fissile material. After the fight, Rutherford joined the crew in examining the severed tentacle. 6 feet thick of oozing gelatinous flesh enveloped a core of wires and circuitry. Nobody knew what alien race had created the things, or to what purpose. Perhaps they'd evolved from some lower technology. This particular leviathan was skinny, almost emaciated. No hope that it had fed recently and would make a half-hearted attempt to haul them in. It must have come in from deep space, traveling for decades or even centuries through the void. Leviathans digested metal and plastic, but fuel, explosives, and especially fissile materials were its primary targets, and the reason leviathans chased ships. Thank God they were so rare.
"Are there any other warships in the system?" Rutherford asked.
"Unfortunately," Norris began. Rutherford cut him off.
"I was talking to the commander. I want you to communicate with engineering, shunt power from the shields and ready countermeasures. Cates, get me the gunnery and see what we've got that might help."
"No, sir, there aren't any warships,"
Commander Pitsfield said in answer to the question.
"There are no Royal Navy vessels in this system, except Vigilant."
"Can we return to the previous jump point? It can't follow us through."
"No, sir," Pitsfield said. "The Leviathan has spit up plasma spores around the jump, a whole web of them. They'll gum up our engines and trap us if we try to go through."
"Sir, may I suggest something?"
Norris said.
"No, Norris, you may not. Do what you were told."
Rutherford turned back to Pitsfield.
"What is our fuel situation?"
"Low, not critical, but we don't have much to spare."
"I don't want to outrun it, only to burn through so much fuel that we can't make the next jump."
Rutherford glanced at Lieutenant Cates, who had been speaking quietly into her comlink.
"Any word from the gunnery?"
She looked up.
"We have no fission weapons on board. They were expended in the bombardment of San Pablo. Nothing else is big enough to drive off the Leviathan. That is the opinion of the gunnery, at least."
Rutherford frowned.
"I see."
That brutal and possibly criminal bombardment of the Hrum continent, as ordered by the Lord Admiral, had not only precipitated a new war, but had left him bereft of the only weapon that could drive off the Leviathan. But what could Rutherford have done, disobey a direct order?
"May I offer a suggestion, Captain?" Cates asked.
"Yes, of course."
"Wait,"
Norris said, looking up.
"How come you listen to her and not me?"
"Because she is not an idiot. And because Rutherford had promoted Catherine Cates himself, had brought her on board after the initiative she'd shown tracking down the mystery of Apex. Norris, on the other hand, was one of Malthorn's toadies foisted on Rutherford to assure his loyalty when he faced his old friend James Drake. And Rutherford was now fairly certain that it was Malthorn who was the traitor to Albion, not Drake and his crew. But Rutherford had no wish to become a tyrant. He needed to put aside his anger.
"One moment, Cates."
"Yes, Norris."
"What about lasers? We have a 50-kilowatt, and we could use it to blind the Leviathan's sensors, maybe even burn off some of its tentacles."
"No, that won't work." Rutherford glanced at Cates, then turned to Pitsfield. "Commander, how long until we fall in range of the Leviathan spore cannons?"
97 minutes,
Pitsfield said.
"Why not?" Norris persisted. "It's not like the thing has Tyrillium armor or anything. Why wouldn't it be susceptible to laser fire? We have an hour and a half. We could concentrate the laser on one spot. If we hurt it enough, it might leave us alone."
Rutherford sighed.
"Norris, a star leviathan can brush through the corona of a star, for God's sake. A 50-kilowatt laser wouldn't even tickle the thing."
"Oh."
Cates had waited while Norris rambled, but she'd been shifting from one foot to the other, leaning forward. She was steady, but still young, and Rutherford had learned to recognize when she was eager to share information. He made his way to her station.
"What is it, Lieutenant?" Rutherford asked.
"Look at this, Captain."
Cates had apparently been running through scans of the system, perhaps looking for other ships that might be bribed or bullied into helping them if there were no Royal Navy vessels about. Unlikely, as the Hades Gulch system was unpopulated, except for a small mining colony. And since Hades Gulch was on the edge of the Omega Cluster, which had no jump points into it, few ships had cause to pass through. This one space lane led to the Griffin Shoals, where Vigilant was supposed to rendezvous with Heartbreak and the rest of the task force. Rutherford leaned over her shoulder and amplified the map. It showed a small, rocky planetoid, unusually positioned between two gas giants. Perhaps an escaped moon, it had a small moon itself, nearly a third as large as the planetoid. Orbiting around them both was a strange double ring of tiny asteroids.
"That ring isn't natural," Kate said. "What you're looking at is debris from a Hroom fleet."
"Debris? There was no battle out here."
"Not in the most recent fighting. This is from the Third Hroom War, Queen Ellen's time."
Kate scrolled her finger across the screen, bringing up text.
"An Albion fleet was chasing them, and several sloops smashed into that small moon while the Hroom were performing desperate evasive maneuvers."
Rutherford eyed Kate's with new appreciation.
"How did you know where to look? I've never heard of this battle. Couldn't have been a pivotal one. Are you some kind of military historian?"
"No, not really. I'd heard about the Battle of Hades Gulch, but didn't know much about it. But there are several ships out there. A salvage operation seems to have taken up a position a couple of years ago, mixed Ladino and New Dutch."
"Do any of them have weapons?"
"Nothing big enough to tangle with a Leviathan. Couple of frigates, some unarmed vessels the size of my old torpedo boat. The planetside base has a small cannon and two missile batteries, but still nothing to speak of. What they do have is a pair of nukes on the surface. Reactors, I mean, the modular stuff. It powers their operations."
"Oh," Rutherford said. Then, with new appreciation, "Oh, fissile material."
"We're 3 hours from the salvage operation," she said, typing on her keypad. "We'll need to accelerate to get there before we're caught, and that means we're back to the fuel problem."
"Yes, but once the Leviathan is feeding, it's no longer our problem. We'll have time to stretch the ram scoops for a couple of days. Send this to Pittsfield."
"I just did, sir."
Rutherford turned it over in his head as he returned to his chair. He imagined the panic in the salvagers as he tore past with a ravenous star Leviathan in pursuit. Their panic might serve as an additional distraction, but that felt unnecessarily cruel. No sense being brutal about it.
"Commander Pittsfield," he said, "contact the salvage operation. Strongly suggest that they run like the devil himself is after them. Warn them we're about to drop a Leviathan in their lap."
A few hours later, the Leviathan had closed to within a few thousand miles as Vigilant rushed toward the salvage operation. Small mining craft, scout vessels, and box-like asteroid scrapers had been fleeing in all directions, like rats boiling out of the hold of a burning ship. One small vessel had been unable to detach itself from a Hroom hulk it had been salvaging, and its workers launched themselves out in an escape pod that was picked up by one of the larger mining ships before it fled. By the time Vigilant tore past the planetoid and its small moon, every man and woman had either fled or hunkered in some deep hole to wait out the catastrophe. Rutherford couldn't just tear through. The Leviathan might not notice all the other juicy morsels to feed on. So he hooked his ship in a big arc, just out of reach of the monster's tentacles, and swooped back toward the planetoid and its moon, shedding speed.
"It's spitting spores," Pittsfield warned, his voice tight and nervous. "One more pass," Rutherford told the pilot. "Take us right through that debris." He got the gunnery on the comm. "Drop some ordnance right next to those reactors. Make them light up."
They came through again, and this time the gunnery let loose with a barrage of torpedoes and missiles, aimed not at the Leviathan, but at the planetoid. Light flashed on the dusty, frozen surface, and giant columns of debris exploded, drifting up and up, before slowly raining down under the world's weak gravity. The Leviathan was now so close that it was probing with its tentacles, trying to snag Vigilant and spewing spore globules from its mouth. But now it hesitated. It swung one arm and looped it around the nose section of a drifting bit of Hroom wreckage, which it pulled toward a suddenly gaping maw. After munching the wreckage, it seemed to spot the undamaged nuclear reactors and dropped toward the surface. This was Vigilant's chance, and she tore off into space, accelerating again. Even as they fled, Rutherford kept a wary eye on the Leviathan. It landed on the planetoid. Miles-long tentacles tore at the surface, throwing up boulders the size of small hills, as the beast stuffed the reactors, the mining buildings, and any other ores, fuel, fissile material, or equipment it could find into its mouth. With both the debris of the Hroom fleet and the remnants of the salvage operation to feed on, Rutherford supposed it would be sated, and shortly venture off into the void, never to be seen again by any living being. With the time lost evading the Leviathan and collecting enough fuel to limp through the jump point, Vigilant would be 3 days longer in leaving Hades Gulch than planned. Rutherford sent subspace messages to the Admiralty and to Captain Harbrake to explain. The Admiralty wouldn't be happy to hear about the destroyed new Dutch operation. To keep the peace, Albion would no doubt feel compelled to offer compensation to the affected salvagers. The fleet counted on new Dutch and Ladino colonies and mining operations for refueling and emergency repair, and couldn't afford to aggravate them while trying to fight the Froom Empire. Rutherford was still 10 hours from the final jump out of this cursed system when they spotted a Froom fleet on the opposite side. Norris, duly chastened because of his failure to spot the Leviathan, had been anxious to properly execute his duties, or it might have passed unnoticed altogether. The fleet comprised 6 sloops of war, entering through a jump point that led from the Phantalus system. The Hroom vessels quickly cloaked themselves and vanished from long-range scans, but not before Lieutenant Swayze, Rutherford's pilot, was able to chart their course. The Hroom were apparently crossing the system on their way to a jump point that would take them into the deep void, a region of space not on any of Rutherford's charts. The jump points in that section of the deep void were constantly shifting and had not previously led anywhere useful. Presumably, the Hroom had a destination in mind, but without better data, Rutherford could only speculate. The enemy was headed away from the Empire worlds. That was one safe guess. Based on the general flow of jump points in these parts, the most likely course was toward one of Albion's homeworlds, Mercia, Saxony, or Albion herself. But why? And with only 6 sloops? That was a strong force, but hardly overwhelming. Even if Albion were unprotected by the fleet, 6 ships wouldn't be sufficient to fight the planet's orbital fortresses long enough to bombard the surface. And away from the planets, HMS Dreadnought alone could fight 6 sloops to a standstill. Give the Admiral's battleship a few destroyers and corvettes, and it would be a slaughter. Still, it was strange to see the Empire on the offensive this far from their home worlds. Strange and unsettling. Rutherford thought briefly about sending a subspace to Griffin Shoals and ordering Harbrake to come through. Vigilant would move to intercept the enemy while waiting for Harbrake's forces to arrive. But Rutherford was low on fuel, and he had disregarded orders for long enough already. Let him make the rendezvous first, find out what Malthorn was up to, and then worry about 6 stray sloops of war. Chapter 4. As soon as he left the Hroom, Drake felt the stress and pressure lifting from his shoulders. Ever since seizing the sugar antidote from Lord Malthorn, he'd felt as though he'd been carrying sandbags on his shoulders. He'd been torn between the moral imperative of freeing the Hroom from their sugar enslavement and the need to protect Albion from a rejuvenated empire. Drake had made his choice, and now General Mose Driz had the antidote. Drake now had 2 things on his mind: freeing his parents from York Tower and punishing Malthorn for killing his sister Helen. Malthorn was a slaver, a warmonger, and a murderer, and somehow Drake would bring him to justice. But first, free his parents. Get them to safety. He led Blackbeard carefully through the Hroom systems, wary of running into the Death Cult faction the general had warned him about. But when the ship reached the frontier systems, he stopped taking unusual precautions and made his way directly toward the new Dutch world of Leopold. Katerina Vargas had recommended Leopold, claiming that there were always freebooters, mercenaries, and other adventurers lurking about its spaceports, looking for work. Pirates and smugglers brought their ships to Leopold's yards for repair and supplies. By the time Blackbeard came into orbit around Leopold, Nearly 5 weeks had passed since they'd left Katarina and Orient Tiger. The planet stretched, dry and hazy, below them, the surface cut by massive brown ranges and dotted with small salty seas, more like large lakes, really. A few patches of green and gold vegetation stood out here and there, marking the limits of human settlement. Only a few million humans and Froom lived on the whole planet. It may have been a hot, dusty rock, but Drake's crew was anxious for landfall, from Commander Tolvern down to the lowest deckhand. The enlisted sorts had blown through much of their earnings from the Terrillium barge before leaving the last port, and what money had remained seemed to have found its way into the hands of people like Carvalho and Lutz, who had an uncanny way of winning at cards and dice. The two men were willing to loan back their winnings, of course, so that the crew could enjoy shore leave. Drake didn't care who owed what to whom, so long as the peace was held. He had no need to land Blackbeard, and it was safer to keep her in orbit. Instead, a shuttle service carried people and goods back and forth to the surface. Tolvern organized a lottery to distribute the 24-hour passes evenly over the 4 days the ship was to remain in orbit. Drake ordered Tolvern to rig the lottery. He didn't want Cap and Carvalho on the ship together when he and Tolvern were on the surface. He trusted them more than he used to, but not fully. Cap complained about this. Couldn't she swap with someone else and go down at the same time as her lover? "I need you with me," Drake told her. "You've got an eye for recruiting. You can tell me who to trust and who not to trust."
"That's true, yeah. But, Captain, me and Carvalho were thinking..."
"There's a bonus in it for you." Her eyebrows went up.
"Bonus?"
"Money. 50 guineas, to be precise." That settled it. There was a fuzzy line between pirate, smuggler, freebooter, and general adventurer here on the frontier. But as was usually the case, the ones who made a killing were the ones who kept their heads down and supplied the rowdier sorts. Most of the money on Leopold seemed to be flowing into two ports on opposite hemispheres, one high in the northern latitudes and the other on a peninsular continent in the south, surrounded on three sides by a shallow, briny sea. The northern hemisphere was cooking in the height of summer, so Drake went south. The shuttle carried him, Tolvern, and Cap to a small settlement called Bryantown. The buildings were red mud brick, and from the air, Bryantown looked like a low-slung tent city alongside a shallow bay. Dry berms divided the bay into squares, each one a mile or two across, and shaded an unnatural color, red, purple, or sickly green. The shuttle driver said they were evaporation ponds to extract dissolved minerals from the sea. As the shuttle came down, a vast flock of pink birds lifted, flapping from the water's edge, and as one bumped off the windshield, Drake was surprised to see that they were old Earth flamingos. The shuttle landed at the spaceport on the edge of town. A motley collection of spacecraft stretched across the tarmac or sat in hangars, these latter visible through open bay doors. Many of the ships were no larger than torpedo boats, salvage vessels, cutters, asteroid scrapers, and the like. But there were several larger frigates and schooners. Armed men patrolled the perimeter of these ships, eyeing each other warily, and Drake was again glad that he hadn't landed Blackbeard. He'd have needed to guard her at all times. The air was so dry, it seemed to suck the moisture from his lungs when the three of them stepped onto the tarmac. No wonder Nib Pym had declined shore leave. The Froom would have withered to a husk in this climate. At least it wasn't overly hot, thanks to their arriving near the shortest day of the year. He paid the shuttle driver who waved them back so he could lift off.
"Well,"
Cap said, scratching at her lion tattoos as they shaded their eyes to watch the shuttle blasting skyward.
"Here we are. Now, how do we get into town?"
"What do we need in town?" Drake asked.
"Gotta find taverns and the like," Cap said. "You know, where these blokes we need are hanging out, like on San Pablo."
"Seems like everything and everyone we need is right here," Drake said.
"But..."
Tolvern patted Cap's shoulder.
"The captain isn't one for bars and taverns. I told you this isn't shore leave. This is work, which is why we're putting gold in your pocket. Don't mean it can't be fun, too."
Cap looked glum.
"Look at me. What did I get dressed up for?"
She wore tight pants and a leather vest unzipped enough to show cleavage. She wore polished black knee-high boots with silver buckles. Eyeshadow gave her eyes a smoky look.
"I was wondering the same thing," Tolvern said. Were you hoping to meet someone? Wouldn't Carvalho be jealous?
Of what?
Cap sounded baffled. Of, you know, giving it to someone else, Tolvern said.
Giving it? Listen to you, old prissy-like. Why should he care? I ain't gonna run out of it or nothing.
King's balls, Tolvern, where are you from anyhow?
Civilization, you might have heard of it.
Drake shook his head, mildly amused, and walked toward one of the larger hangars to his right. The others followed. As he walked, he took in the spaceships, the lorries, shuttling workers and supplies around, the cranes, moving pieces of decking, and other heavy equipment. He'd been hoping to spot a familiar ship, but Orient Tiger was not in evidence. He'd known that, of course. He'd sent coded subspace messages upon entering the system, and Katarina had not responded. Still, one could hope. Katarina clearly knew the world, and it was as good a place to put in for repairs and resupply as any. A lorry with 6-foot-high tires rumbled out of one of the hangars, pulling a frigate on a wheeled trundle. The aft portion of the ship, from the side-mounted cannon to the engines, had the clean, sleek profile of a Royal Navy corvette, but the prow was the stubby nose of some other ship, painted to resemble a shark's toothy snarl. Painted across the side, in big block letters, Outlaw.
I wonder if that's Robertson's old ship, Drake said.
Who?
Cap asked.
Edward Robertson, Tolvern filled in. Got rammed by a sloop a couple of years ago, and the crew abandoned ship. Captain sent around a salvage operation after we'd driven off the room, but someone had already snagged the wreckage and made off with it. We always wondered if it was pirates.
Cap grinned.
Good for them. Royal Navy don't need it half so bad.
I could use a corvette, Drake said. Or a half-corvette. Let's see who earns her.
But when they approached, men with shotguns and hand cannons moved quickly to block them.
"Who is the captain of the ship?" Drake asked.
"What's it to you?"
one of the men asked. He was broad-shouldered, with a square jaw and a mustache with waxed ends. He wore leather bracers on his arms and a saber in a sheath at his side instead of a firearm.
"I would rather speak to your captain. Is he available for inquiries?"
"Well, listen to you talking all posh-like,"
the man said, and his companions laughed.
"Now get the hell out of here."
"Shut your gob," Cap said.
She put a hand on her sidearm.
"Nobody talks to the captain like that, you hear?"
The men tensed, and Drake pulled Cap back. There were 6 armed men guarding the frigate, and he hadn't come to fight anyway. Cap removed her hand from the weapon, scowling.
"Wouldn't hurt him none to be civil, anyhow."
"That goes for all of us," Drake told her.
He turned back to the fellow who seemed to be the leader of the guard detail.
"I'm looking to hire a couple of ships, and I have ready money to spend."
At the mention of money, the men looked less eager to fight and more intrigued.
"When?"
the leader asked.
"Immediately."
"Ah, then nope. We're already hired on for some business or other," the man said. "Don't know what, you'll have to ask the captain."
"May I speak with him?"
"Not now, you can't. The officers went into town to buy provisions. Won't be back until tomorrow, I figure. If you're looking to hire someone, you could talk to Pete Paradis. I know he's looking for work for his crew. Just got back off salvage and his gear was wrecked up good. That business in Hades Gulch, you hear about it?"
"No," Drake said. "We were beyond the frontier."
"Bloody Leviathan. Figure Paradis will tell you about it. That's his ship over there."
The man hooked his thumb at a lanky schooner sitting on the tarmac, where 2 men were scraping barnacles, while 2 others worked on deck plating with blowtorches. The schooner was half the size of Outlaw, which in turn wasn't as big as Katarina Vargas's Orient Tiger. 12 crew max, not much larger than a Navy torpedo boat. Drake would need 20 ships that size to do any good.
"I suppose we should talk to this Paradis fellow," Drake told his companions when the men had returned to guarding the frigate, still inching its way across the tarmac.
"But let's see if we can hire Outlaw first. Wouldn't do us any good to land Paradis, only to find out the 2 captains are enemies and we're stuck with the lesser ship."
"I suppose we'll have to go into town after all," Tolvern said.
Cap rubbed her hands together.
"Now we're talking."
"I forgot to get the name of Outlaw's captain," Drake said.
"It would be easier to find out now rather than ask around town like idiots."
He made to approach the frigate, but Tolvern put a hand on his forearm and stopped him.
"I don't think that's necessary," she said. "Look."
The rear of the frigate was now visible as the lorry turned toward a gaping hangar to the left. The name of the ship had been painted again above the plasma engines, but this time below Outlaw was a smaller word. Vargas. Chapter 5. Vargas, Jess Tolvern thought bitterly, as a jitney carried them toward town on a dusty, brush-lined road. Camels grazed the thorny bushes along the road. Others rested in the shade of an abandoned lorry, its tires hauled off, the windshield smashed, and the paint scoured by the blowing sand. Why that name again? They'd fought the elder Captain Vargas twice, once defeating his ship, Captain Kidd, and a second time when the pirate captain attacked them in the San Pablo yards. And then Captain Drake had become entangled with the man's daughter, Katerina Vargas. Tolvern had bumbled into Drake's quarters, thinking she'd seduce him, only to find him naked in the shower with Katerina. The crappy thing about an embarrassing memory, the most shameful part of shame, so to speak, was how it could spring forth in full glory at any moment. It was hard to stay angry forever, or envious, or any other negative emotion. But recall an embarrassing incident, and there it was, leering, until you were blushing all over again. Now she was remembering the look on Katerina Vargas's face when the woman stepped out of the shower, naked and beautiful, to see Tolvern struggling to button up after having stripped down. What a nightmare. Thank God Vargas had covered for her. If the captain had found out, she'd have never been able to face him again. Katerina Vargas must be in Bryantown with a new ship, and from the anticipation on the captain's face as the jitney rumbled among the red mud-brick buildings, he was anxious to see her again. Tolvern was not. Cap sat in the back of the open jitney with Tolvern, while the captain sat up front with the driver. She studied Tolvern.
"Something the matter?"
"No, nothing."
"You ain't happy to see Vargas again, are you?"
"I haven't given her a moment's thought,"
Tolvern lied. She pulled the computer out of her hip pocket and brought up an info sheet about Bryantown. Drake glanced back.
"Anyway, we don't know that it's her. Probably not, in fact. Katerina has other ships, and I don't imagine she'd leave Orient Tiger unless she found something better. Outlaw is an inferior vessel."
"That lady is a pirate," Cap said. "And when you're a pirate, sometimes you don't got no choice in the matter. Could have been the Navy roughed her up and she had to find something else."
Tolvern scrolled through until she found something useful.
"We're looking for a place called the Apple Pie Trading Company."
Cap snorted.
"What the... Did you say apple pie?"
"It's just a name," Tolvern said. "A place where people meet to do business. They're not actually bartering baked goods." She scrolled again. "They offer food and drink, though."
Cap looked suspicious.
"What kind of drink?"
"Don't worry, Cap. It's the usual libations, I'm sure. Grog, hooch, firewater, demon rum, gin."
"Whew, you had me worried there for a minute. Apple Pie Trading Company. King's balls, what a name."
Bryantown wasn't a big place, maybe 5,000 or 6,000 people from the looks of it, and the jitney driver dropped them in front of the Apple Pie Trading Company a few minutes later. The establishment was a restaurant on the edge of the sea, with most of the patrons sitting on a patio beneath a big sun awning, looking down at the bay. Outside and below, scrawny dogs trotted along the shoreline, fighting with crabs over dead fish that had washed up. The smell of brine and rotting seaweed wafted in. The patrons were mostly disreputable sorts, as expected. They drank tankards of grog and cracked the claws of some strange lobster-like crustacean, sucking out the meat and tossing the empty shells and the legs over the railing. Tolvern's eyes were drawn to one table in particular. There she was, Katerina Vargas, her shoulder thrown back to show her neck, a drink in one hand. She'd cut her black curls to a bob, like Tolvern's, but the curve of her chin was the same, the lines of her neck. A wiry, middle-aged Ladino sat with her, gesticulating as he spoke. Cap nudged Tolvern. She stared in dismay, waiting for Drake to finish talking to the proprietor, who insisted on taking their drink order before allowing them to sit. As soon as Drake looked up, he'd spot her. Why? Bryantown was small, no more than a few thousand people, and the whole planet only had a handful of ports. So it wasn't that big of a coincidence on the surface, but
But if you considered all the other systems, all the other places Katarina might have gone, why here?
Hi, Captain, Cap said. You see what we're seeing?
Henny Cap seemed to have one volume level, loud, and her voice drew the attention of Katarina Vargas and her companion. They looked up, and Tolvern did a double take. It was not Katarina Vargas after all, but some other woman. This woman was a few years older than Katarina, perhaps in her early 30s, and had an ugly scar from her forehead to her cheek and across one eye. It looked like a saber slash, and she'd lost her left eye to it. In its place was an artificial eye, whose pupil dilated and narrowed as the woman studied the newcomers. She was not Katarina, but she looked awfully similar.
"Now this is interesting," Drake murmured. "Come on."
The woman and her companion rose warily as the three officers from Blackbeard approached. Everyone was armed, but all parties kept their hands in the open.
"Are you the bloke who was asking about my ship at the yards?"
the woman asked.
"Yeah, they called to warn me. Did you think they wouldn't?"
"That's right. I'm looking to hire a few ships."
"What for?"
Tolvern stared. That voice, so similar. The face, too. And it had said Vargas on the back of the frigate at the yards. This woman's accent was rougher, and that scar and artificial eye had altered her appearance, but she had to be related to Katarina.
"Are you available for hire?" Drake asked.
"Matter of fact, I'm not."
She nodded toward her companion.
"Just formed a partnership with this fellow here. We're waiting for one more bloke, then we're figuring on heading into orbit and hoofing it out of here. You got a ship of your own? You look like it. We could use a fourth, especially if you've got cannon and a couple of torpedo bays."
"Oh, we have weapon systems," Drake said. "That's not what we're lacking."
The woman looked intrigued.
"Let's hear it, then."
She gestured at her companion, who dragged over chairs from a nearby table. Drake nodded at Cap and Tolvern, and the three of them sat.
"I gotta know," Cap burst in. "Are you sister of that lady what's captain of Orient Tiger? Bloody hell, you look just like her, except for the..."
Cap tapped next to her eye.
"You know."
"Ensign, hold your tongue," Tolvern said.
"It's all right," Drake said. "I've been wondering the same thing. You and Katarina Vargas must be related somehow."
They stopped as the proprietor approached with a tray holding shot glasses. It smelled like tequila filtered through an old sock. Tolvern took a sip of hers and tried not to grimace. Cap downed hers and smacked her lips.
"That'll do the trick."
"Yes, I am," the woman said at last. "I'm one of the Vargas girls, Isabel, the eldest. What do you know of me?"
"One of the Vargas girls?" Tolvern asked. "Wonderful. There are four of us. The old man loved his daughters." A note of sarcasm entered Isabel Vargas's voice.
"You know my father is dead, right? Shot in a fight in the San Pablo yards."
"Yes, so they say," Drake said smoothly. "Sorry to hear it." Isabel shrugged.
"Didn't get along with him much, so..."
She downed her drink. Still, Tolvern thought it best not to offer details. She'd been the one to kill the pirate captain. Her own gun. A lucky shot as the elder Vargas ran for cover.
"You could say we have plenty of issues in the Vargas family,"
Isabel said. "Katarina gave me this." She indicated her artificial eye.
"I'm hoping to hire your sister too," Drake said. "So if that's a problem..."
"Yeah, back to that. No worries about little sis. We'll work together if we have to. But I got another thing going now."
A gesture toward her companion.
"Like I was saying earlier, why don't you join us?"
"Unfortunately, I am otherwise engaged," Drake said. "I will have to decline your offer."
"In that case, give me a month, and I'll be free for your job, whatever that is, assuming the pay is good."
"It is," Drake said.
"But we don't have a month," Tolvern added. 3 weeks, maybe, if we push it."
Isabel sounded intrigued, and Tolvern could tell she was having a hard time not grabbing for both opportunities, Drake's and the one offered by her Ladino companion.
"No," Drake said. "I need to leave now. It's a rescue mission, and every day counts. I'd rather not arrive to find them executed because I took my time."
"A rescue mission?" Isabel asked. "How does that pay?"
"Well enough, I promise you," Drake said. "We'll pay you up front."
"There might be loot, too," Tolvern added.
"There might be," Drake said.
I can't guarantee the loot, but if there is, there could be a good deal of it. There absolutely would be, Tolvern thought, if they could get their hands on it. Drake's parents were imprisoned in York Tower, on the edge of King Bartholomew's palace compound. The Royal Mint kept gold and silver bullion in the vaults attached to the tower. It was the kind of loot that would make 1,000 pirate captains drool. Not easy to get to, of course, not at all. All right, then, Isabel said. You lay out your job, and I'll lay out mine, and we'll figure out which is the most lucrative.
I thought we had a deal, the Ladino said, scowling. You're going to weasel out now?
I'm not weaseling anything, Isabel said. We were still discussing matters. Besides, do you really need that gear back so bad?
It's not just my gear, it's all the other abandoned stuff.
Pete lost his shirt during that Leviathan attack a couple of weeks ago, Isabel said. You hear about that? Out in Hades Gulch. We're fixing to go back to the gulch and get what's left of his gear, and anything else we can find, too.
Sounds dangerous, Drake said. Even more dangerous than what I'm offering, in fact. You can't fight a Leviathan.
Don't intend to. We'll scan before we go in, make sure it's not around. Only thing is, we've got to be the first ones back. Isabel lifted out of her chair. Where is Dunkley? He went to the crapper 20 minutes ago. That's the third guy on our team. You can make it 4 if you want. Or you can throw down some gold and we'll get your thing done instead.
Pete, where is he?
She asked her companion.
Want me to go look for him?
The Ladino asked.
Nah.
Tolvern had been putting a few things together and now said,
Pete Paradis? You have that schooner they were scraping barnacles off at the yards?
Yeah,
the Ladino said warily.
That's mine.
I thought you and Vargas were enemies, Tolvern said. That's what our men told us.
He shrugged and played with his empty shot glass before waving for the bartender to bring another round.
Well, Tolvern asked, are you enemies, I mean?
What does that mean out here? Isabel said. My sister gave me this bad eye and I just told your captain I'd work with her again. Bit of bad blood between me and Pete, but we'll work through it. Now I have no permanent enemies. I'm not like my old man, bloody fool, who got himself killed trying to get his revenge. He was an idiot.
Are you sure you don't have any permanent enemies? Tolvern asked nervously.
Isabel had been playing with the strap of the holster at her side as she spoke, and it wasn't hard to imagine her whipping out her gun when she heard that the people responsible for her father's death were sitting across the table.
Nope, none. You got someone hard to work with, I'm good with that, so long as you cross my palm with silver.
She may not have enemies, Cap said suddenly. But I do.
She rose to her feet.
Dunkley, you son of a... King's balls, I was wondering if that was you.
A man had come strolling across the patio floor, cinching up his belt. He looked pale, like he'd eaten something strange, and had one hand on his belly. No wonder he'd been in the bathroom for so long. He studied Cap, his eyes widening in recognition.
Cap, old buddy, what are you doing out here? Thought they sent your sorry butt to the mines. Shut your gob! I hope they at least gave you a good flogging.
Cap's nostrils flared. Before Tolvern and Drake could grab her, she lowered her head and barreled forward. Her head drove into Dunkley's belly. The man fell with an oof, with Cap on top of him. She came up swinging. He was bigger than she was, but couldn't seem to get out from under her, and it would have gone very badly for him if Tolvern and Drake hadn't reached the fight. They each took one of Cap's arms and dragged her back. She struggled and cursed.
Ensign, Drake snapped. In your seat!
Cap settled down. She pulled free and sat down sullenly. Paradis looked alarmed, but Isabel Vargas was chuckling and shaking her head with amusement.
Ah, it's a funny universe that brings together two old mates.
Cap shot Isabel a look.
Don't seem funny to me.
Dunkley rose to his feet and felt at his jaw.
What the hell is your problem, Cap?
You know my problem.
That's your style, isn't it? Don't like what a bloke says and you punch him.
What did the captain call you that time? Remind me, why don't you?
Cap sprang to her feet again, but this time Tolvern and Drake were ready and pulled her back down.
Keep your temper,
Tolvern warned her,
or you'll be off the bridge in 2 seconds and scraping barnacles. You got that?
Yeah, I got it, Tolvern.
Cap glared at Dunkley as he came and slowly sat on the farthest side of the table, never taking his eyes off her. You know what this tosser did? I'll tell you. He got me arrested. That was your own damn temper, Dunkley said. He glanced around the table before settling his gaze on Tolvern. Cap stormed onto the bridge and punched our captain in the nose. Gave me 30 bloody months, Cap grumbled. She grabbed another drink from a passing tray. Her anger seemed to be deflating. I thought you caught him cheating at cards, Tolvern said. That's what you told me. Cap hooked her thumb at Dunkley. That's what he said, found me when I was drinking and got me all wound up saying how the captain was cheating. You did that on purpose, Dunkley, and don't go and deny it. How was I supposed to know you'd act like a bloomin' idiot?
Enough, Drake said. Cap fell silent. He studied Dunkley. If you were Cap's shipmate, what are you doing out here?
My enlistment ran out a couple of months ago, so I came looking for work. You know I wasn't trying to get you thrown in the brig, Cap. Then I sure didn't mean for you to get 30 months in the mines.
Yeah, well, I ain't there, am I?
Isabel Vargas leaned back with her hands behind her head. She had a wide, slightly inebriated smile on her face.
Dunkley only showed up 6 weeks ago from what I heard, broken looking for work. Now he's got his own schooner. Kinda suspicious if you ask me.
It was legit, Dunkley said.
Pete Paradis snorted and downed his liquor.
Sure it was.
None of our business either way.
Vargas eyed Drake.
Well, sir, let's get properly introduced. This one must be your first mate, Tolvern, right? And the feisty one is Cap, I got that. You know us all by now. Who would you be?
Drake hesitated, and Tolvern saw him formulating a story. But Drake wasn't much more of a liar than the Hroom General, and even before he spoke, she knew he'd tell some version of the truth.
My name is Captain James Drake, formerly of the Royal Navy, now in business for myself.
Isabel straightened and glanced at her companions. Dunkley stiffened, but Paradis looked confused until Isabel whispered something in his ear, and then his eyes widened, and he appraised them with greater attention. Isabel took in Cap and Tolvern with a more cautious look, before returning her gaze to the captain.
So you know my family already, it would seem, Isabel said.
Another look at Tolvern. All of you do.
Yes, Tolvern said.
She kept her hand where it could get to her pistol.
No permanent enemies, you said?
These prisoners you're looking for, Isabel said, ignoring the question and speaking to the captain instead.
They wouldn't happen to be on Albion, would they?
Let's say maybe they are, Drake answered.
And you've got money?
8,000 to hire your frigate. 3,000 apiece for the two schooners. I'm sure that's more than the three of you hope to get from this Leviathan thing.
You could say that, if you can pay.
And if you can contact Katerina, Drake added, I'll offer her 12 to hire Orient Tiger. It's a bigger ship, you understand, more crew to pay, more expensive to repair.
I can reach her, and for 12,000 she'll be interested.
Isabel's mechanical eye kept narrowing and dilating.
That's 26,000 pounds. How do I know you're good for it?
Your sister can confirm that I have the money. She's the one who helped me earn it.
Tolvern studied him. He did have the money, but after paying the crew of Blackbeard, that would clear out his massive haul in the Terillium barge operation. He'd be left with nothing.
That makes two frigates, two schooners, and your own ship, Isabel said. You still flying that Navy cruiser you stole, modified with all the crap you looted from my dad's ship?
That's right.
Hefty little armada you'll have there, but we've got to rush Albion. That's your mission.
That's right, he said again.
Isabel let out a low whistle.
I mean, that's good money, but it's not exactly life-changing for someone in my boots. I could upgrade my ship, set a little aside, sure. Doesn't help if I'm dead, though.
Can't speak for these blokes, but I'm not sure even 8,000 is worth it for me and my crew. Not unless you can guarantee that we'll all survive.
I can guarantee no such thing, Drake said. There's an excellent chance someone will die. Maybe we'll lose a whole ship if we're unlucky. But here's what I'll do. I'll pay you half in orbit, and half when we go through the last jump point. Then, when we finish the mission, I'll give you another 8. He looked at Paradis and Dunkley. 3 more for each of you. A bonus. Share it with your crews or keep it for yourself, that's up to you. And that's on top of any loot we take, which we will divide according to standard practice.
This time, Tolvern carefully did not look at the captain,
He didn't have the kind of money he was promising, she was sure of that. He'd just pledged over £50,000, of which at least 20 was offered on pure swagger. He'd have to sell his father's estate to get funds like that, and the barony was currently in the hands of Melthorn and his cronies. A warm breeze blew in from the sea, carrying the smell of brine and decaying seaweed. Below the patio, two dogs started fighting, snarling and barking, until someone at one of the other tables fired his gun over their heads, and they raced off, howling.
"I'm in," Dunkley said. "For 6,000, you bet I am. Buddies again, Cap?"
Cap grunted.
"Sure, I guess. Mates, buddies, whatever. That's what Captain wants. That's what I'll do."
"I'm in too," Paradis said. "I'm flat broke, and me and my crew were already planning to go sniffing around where that Star Leviathan was. Can't be more dangerous than that. Besides, we saw a Hroom fleet in Hades Gulch on our way out. That's more than enough trouble for one godforsaken star system."
A Hroom fleet? That was strange. Hades Gulch was on the edge of the Omega Cluster, which had no known jump points into it. Where would the Empire have been sending those ships?
"Well then, that's settled," Isabel said. She waved to the bartender to get his attention. "Hurry up, we're thirsty. You people eaten yet? The apple pie is pretty good if you need something other than liquid refreshment."
"Apple pie," Cap said.
"I knew it. You hear that, Telvan?"
"Does that mean we have a deal?" Drake asked. "We got a deal, yeah," Isabel said.
"Assuming my sister will have you."
"Oh, she'll have him, all right," Telvan thought gloomily. "Yes, I believe she will," Drake said, his measured tone giving away nothing. If Tolvern hadn't seen him in the shower with Katerina, she'd have suspected nothing. The bartender set a drink in front of Isabel, and she picked it up and held it out, as if in a mock toast.
"Then you have yourself a fleet, Captain Drake."
Chapter 6. There was trouble getting out of orbit. Paradis owed the yards £700 that he was unable to cover, and the welders and crane operators took his crew captive and refused to let the schooner out of impound until someone coughed up the money. Drake reluctantly paid out from Paradis's £3,000, an advance. Good chance that money would vanish, along with Paradis, the first time they went through a jump point. Then, while half the motley fleet was still planetside, another ship, a pirate frigate by the unlikely name of Pussycat, showed up from the outer worlds of the system, demanding a piece of the action. The captain of Pussycat, a man named Aguilar, warned that he'd alert Albion if he wasn't allowed to join the flotilla. Some on Blackbeard, Cap and Barker chief among them, advocated blowing Pussycat out of space to serve as a lesson to the rest. But Isabel Vargas said that Pussycat and her crew could be reliable if properly paid. Drake wanted that ship. Pussycat looked like a deformed warthog, her squat profile banged up from numerous fights, and her engines undersized. But she bristled with weapons. That would give Drake a cruiser, two frigates, and a pair of schooners. And if Isabel located her sister and Orient Tiger, he'd have a third frigate. But he couldn't make the numbers work to pay them all. He was in the war room drumming his fingers on the table, a message to Pussycat half-composed, when Tolvern came in.
"Got another message from Aguilar," she said. "He has someone in the yards, someone who tipped him off in the first place, and he knows Vargas is fueling Outlaw and will be in orbit soon. We'll be ready to go as soon as Outlaw is up, and Aguilar doesn't want to be left behind. He's threatening to send a subspace to Albion if we don't agree to his terms by the time Vargas takes off. That's 20 minutes.
When Drake didn't answer, she pulled up a chair.
"Captain, you have to decide. It's either knock him out of the sky or hire him on. I know you want that ship, so..."
"Aguilar wants 8,000, Drake said. "I don't have it."
"You don't have half of what you promised. So bluff, agree to his terms and figure it out later."
"The problem is, I've got to hand over the last of my money as soon as we're in the Albion system. All the money I've legitimately got, that is. If we get there, and I pay out 26 to the pirates and 6 to my crew, then I literally have nothing. I can't pay another 8 to Aguilar. And when I don't come up with the money, the rest will see I was bluffing about the final payoff, the bonus. They'll know." Of course, Isabel Vargas and the rest would be mad as hell once they'd risked their lives to run the forts, attack Yorktown, and rescue Drake's parents. If they all turned on him, he'd be dead. but he was pretty sure Katarina wouldn't attack him, and maybe they'd take loot from York Tower, look at the damage they'd suffered in the assault, and count themselves good. Why risk another brawl with Blackbeard that would get more of them killed?
"Is it just Aguilar's 8,000 holding you back?" Tolvern asked.
"Well, that and the fact that he's already proven himself a treacherous snake before he's even joined the fleet. A true pirate."
"Good, then he fits right in."
Drake smiled. "Yes, it's just the 8,000.
Tolvern reached below her vest and pulled out a key on a chain. She set it on the table.
"This opens my strongbox in the hold. My cut of the Tyrillium Hall was £4,100. I've spent less than 100, and the rest is in the safe. It's yours."
"You can't do that."
"No, really. What would I do with all of that money? When I think that my father is the chief steward of Baron Drake's estate and is only paid 450 a year, that kind of money seems unreal to me."
"Piracy pays well," Drake said, "until they hang you."
"Malthorn attacked my home too," she said. "The Tolverns have been treated well by the Drakes for 5 generations, and you can bet my father wants Malthorn punished and his old master back on the estate."
Drake picked up the key and rubbed it thoughtfully.
"Thank you, Jess."
She blushed at the use of her given name, but Drake knew she enjoyed the familiarity, the friendship beyond commanding officer and subordinate. This was friendship she was offering him, not mere loyalty. He'd find a way to pay her back somehow.
"That's half of it," he said. "What about the other 4,000?
"Ask Vargas, the other sister, I mean. Offer Katarina 8 instead of 12. It's what her sister is getting."
"For a weaker ship, Orient Tiger is worth more than Outlaw and deserves more. And Katarina has more crew to pay. Plus, the Vargas clan doesn't seem to always get along, if you haven't noticed. What makes you think she'd agree to it?"
"Because you've worked together already. Katarina knows you and trusts you in a way Isabel doesn't."
"All the more reason not to cheat her. Can you imagine me talking her into accepting 8,000, then cheating her out of the bonus on the other side as well?"
"James," she said, using his given name this time. "Let's be frank with each other."
"What do you mean?" he asked warily.
"I know. About you and Katarina, I mean. Please, you don't need to deny it. I know, just trust me, I know. You were lovers, and you parted on good terms. You have every reason to expect she would take a lower cut in return for being reunited with you."
Drake licked his lips. A twinge of guilt worked at his gut. Did the rest of the crew know, too? Did they think him a hypocrite for all the times he'd warned about fraternization, or frowned at Cap and Carvalho for being lovers, even as he let himself get involved with Katarina Vargas?
"I feel like I should apologize," he said.
"We don't have time for that, Captain. Aguilar is expecting an answer. If you don't have one, we need to warn the gunnery there will be a fight."
Her words weren't condemning, but there was no hiding the frown in her voice, with more than a hint of disapproval. Of course, Tolvern would never let herself be put in such a compromising position.
"We don't even know if Isabel will be able to reach her sister, and if she does, then Katarina might decline the offer anyway.
If she'd wanted to stay with me, she could have followed us into Froom space. Maybe she'll say no this time, too."
"In that case, problem solved. You give her share to Aguilar, and I keep my £4,000.
"Very well, we'll hire this villain and his crew of pirates. Offer him 8,000 plus the so-called bonus on the other end."
Tolvern touched her ear.
"Jane, open a channel to Pussycat."
She glanced back at Drake with a raised eyebrow.
"I'm going to get really tired of saying Pussycat before we're done. Is this Aguilar? This is Commander Jess Tolvern of Starship Blackbeard. Captain Drake would like to hire your services, subject to the following non-negotiable conditions."
Drake was not surprised that Isabel Vargas made contact with her sister in short order once money was on the line. Katarina and the crew of Orient Tiger were on their way to Hades Gulch. Katarina had apparently got wind of the Star Leviathan attack and, like her sister, had decided to pick over the carcass of the salvage operation. Drake agreed to take his fleet and rendezvous with Orient Tiger there. It took 8 days of travel to reach the system, and another 2 to reach the small, cold planetoid and its moon, where Orient Tiger was hard at work scooping up the Leviathan's leftovers. Drake was wary of the deep space monster, but they scanned carefully and didn't spot it.
It must have wandered off. Isabel's ship, Outlaw, pulled ahead of the others as they slowed for the rendezvous and arrived first, flashing past Orient Tiger in a way that seemed to irritate the younger sister. Katerina showed her guns and torpedo bays, and for a moment it looked like the Vargas sisters would mix it up. Drake sent urgent messages, but they ignored him. It was only when he retracted his own shields to expose his main cannons that they stopped feinting and threatening each other. Drake was in the captain's chair when he got Katerina on the viewscreen. He'd been irritated by the bickering between the two sisters, but that vanished when he saw her smiling back at him. She was as beautiful as ever, and played with the ruby pendant resting on the swell of her breasts.
"What was that about?" he asked.
"That business with my sister? You know, sibling love. She is the older one, always wants to lord it over me. Rather a shame that I have the bigger ship, isn't it?" There was something else in their history, he thought, hearing Katerina speak. She sounded refined, like a lady of Albion, whereas Isabel spoke with a rougher, flatter accent. Not lower class, like Cap or some of the others in Drake's crew, but it wasn't the sort of accent one developed in finishing school either. He wondered if their father hadn't favored his younger daughter, sent her to Albion to make something respectable out of her, but hadn't given Isabel the same opportunity. Then there was the injury and artificial eye that marred the older sister's appearance. What was the story of that? "So," Katerina said, "I got your message. Can you talk openly, or do you need a private channel?" Drake glanced at the rest of the crew on board. Cap and Tolvern were off shift, and Manx was in the science facility with Brockett, which left Smythe at the tech console and Nib Pym in the pilot's chair. Smythe was a tech geek and semi-oblivious when it came to human interaction, and Nib Pym was a hroom.
"I can talk here. What is it?"
"Money," Katerina said. "Do you have it?"
"I have the 8 I promised you."
"Right," she said. "I'm not too happy about that. My ship completely outclasses my sister's. You saw how easily I flanked her just now."
"I was ignoring all of the posturing, to be honest."
"And I'm twice as reliable and steady in battle. But that is not what I'm talking about. I know what you took from the Tyrillium Hall. Even figuring you've held onto it since we last met, that's going to leave you short."
Drake thought about bluffing her, too, and claiming that the Hroom had paid him off for the sugar antidote. Instead, he shrugged. Katerina peered back through the viewscreen.
"You must have a very different relationship with your parents than I had with mine, if you're willing to beggar yourself and risk the wrath of Isabel and the rest to save them."
"Does that mean you'll do it?"
"For 8,000, no. I can get an easy 2,000 on this salvage job before the competition shows up, and nobody will be shooting at me."
"Katerina, listen to me. It is your Qatar. Do you know what is in the vaults?"
"It's not worth my life."
"Who said anything about your life?"
"James, are you trying to tell me that we'll skate past Albion's forts unscathed? Or will some of us die and the rest of us be well mauled by the time we come out the other side?"
"Not unscathed," he admitted. "But the fleet is out fighting the Hroom."
"Not Dreadnought. She's still in orbit, finishing repairs."
"Not any more. From what Rutherford said..."
"Rutherford, ha! He's a bigger scoundrel than Paradis and Dunkley put together."
Katerina had apparently not forgiven Rutherford for fighting her during the battle with the Apex hunting party.
"You know what I want," she added. "Give me that, and I'll gladly come along."
Drake glanced at Nib Pym and Smythe. The former was running calculations, and the latter was on the comm, speaking with engineering about a debris field they'd have to navigate as they left the orbit of the planetoid and its moon.
"Well, James, surely you've thought about what I was telling you last time."
Yes, he had. They'd made love on her ship, then she'd showed him scans of the planet she'd discovered in the Omega Cluster.
"The planet is beautiful, James, fertile and untouched. I didn't want to leave. Next time I pass through, I won't. Neither will anyone else who comes with me."
"I can't, Katerina," he said. "It's not just my parents. It's Lord Malthorn."
"The devil take him. Why do you care?"
"Because I do. Malthorn has started a new war that may see Albion destroyed."
So you want to remove him to end the war, or what?
I don't know. I need to see what Rutherford does first.
Well then, I guess I'll wish you all the best and hope you come out the other side alive. Oh, and be careful around my sister. She's a predator.
Katerina smiled.
Where do you think I learned my moves?
Katerina, please.
No! Her eyes flashed. What I'm offering, nobody else can give you. That's more than enough. And if you don't want it, if you won't take it, then you know what I need instead. Money and plenty of it. Until then, you get nothing from me.
He looked at her, sadly, wishing he could give her what she wanted, could promise it anyway. He shouldn't have hired Aguilar. Without the money he'd committed to the captain and crew of Pussycat, he could have afforded the more powerful Orient Tiger. Tolvern had convinced him that he could have both. It was a bit of foolish sentiment from the commander, thinking that Katerina had any real feelings for Drake. Katerina sighed.
But I suppose information is free. There's something you should know. Are you planning to go back via Phantalus, then through the Griffin Shoals?
That's right.
Don't. There's a big navy fleet running between those two systems. I didn't see Rutherford's ship, but there were a fair number of other cruisers and destroyers and the like. You don't want to tangle with them.
Very good. Thank you. The news worried him. The other routes were circuitous and would add at least a week to his journey, but he couldn't risk a fight with the Navy, and he couldn't risk being detected approaching Albion.
You have time. Don't rush your approach.
I don't know if I do. I have no idea what Malthorn is planning to do with my parents.
I do, Katerina said enigmatically. She smiled, and much of her charm returned. I picked up some news from the Albion press. Your parents have been declared traitors, and they are being tried by the Crown.
That is ridiculous.
It may be ridiculous, she said, but surely it's time-consuming to try a baron and his wife for treason, am I right?
Yes, maybe so. Could take weeks, even months.
Maybe he did have time after all.
Thank you, this is helpful.
So which route will you take now that Phantalus and the Shoals are closed off?
I don't know. And I probably shouldn't say it in front of you and your crew if you're not coming along. Unless you've changed your mind.
No, I am serious about that. I'm guessing you'll cross the gulch, then jump into the Jericho system. That's the only way forward unless you want to either risk that navy fleet or backtrack to the frontier.
Maybe, maybe not. There are other ways.
Don't be coy, James. I'm trying to help you. The thing is, we just came from Jericho. I stumbled into a Hroom fleet in the system. If they had wanted my hide, I'd be dead now. But they had other business to attend to. They seemed to be headed the same direction you are.
Drake's thoughts turned to what General Mose Driz had told him. The Hroom death fleet. Of course, it couldn't approach Albion directly either, but would be plotting a similarly circuitous route.
You should be all right if you can avoid them, Katerina said. There were several sloops, but the Hroom weren't powerful enough to defeat the Albion fleet I saw, or mess with Dreadnought for that matter.
That's because they don't intend to defeat the fleet. They intend to destroy Albion.
You'd better stay out of their way, though, Katerina added. If you and my sister fly in parallel, running your long-range scanners...
Isabel doesn't have long-range scanners, Drake interrupted. Blast, some of his previous decisions were coming back to haunt him. The arrays were knocked out in a fight, and it's one of the main reasons she was on Leopold, looking for work to earn the money for new arrays before she sets off alone again.
Isn't that just like Isabel operating on a shoestring? What about the other ships? How about that ugly frigate, the one that looks like a floating tank?
Pussycat. Her instruments are rubbish, Drake said. She's a brawler, not a chaser. Good for close combat. But if she's out in the void, unescorted, not so tough. That's why Aguilar was so keen to join me. He's in no position for solo operations either.
Tolvern walked onto the bridge. She glanced at the viewscreen, sighed audibly at the sight of Katerina Vargas, and made her way to her seat, shaking her head.
Drake thought it was time to wrap up this conversation. Thank you for the information. I'll keep my scanners going, and with any luck, we'll spot them before they spot us.
I'm warning you, James. If you run into the sloops, they'll give you a good thrashing. Stay clear.
What choice do I have?
Katerina grunted. Fine, I'll see you to the last jump point, but no farther.
Drake blinked. You will?
£2,000.
£2,000 for an escort? Isn't that rather steep for support duties? We're already plenty strong without you.
Strong, but with a single eye. I can't match Blackbeard's firepower, but my instruments are more than a match. £2,000, and another £2,000 if we come into combat, and only until the last jump point. Then you're on your own. Piracy, Tolvern said in a loud voice.
Drake considered the offer. Katerina was right. Drake couldn't afford to mix it up with the Whom. It wouldn't do him any good to get to Albion if he'd already taken significant damage, and the transit time would give him opportunities to change Katerina's mind. He nodded. It's a deal.
Chapter 7. Within the first half hour after recovering from the jump into the Griffin Shoals, Rutherford had received 2 urgent, conflicting messages. He went to the war room to consider them in privacy. The first was from the Lord Admiral, ordering him to collect his task force and cross the shoals to the far side of the system, where he would rendezvous with a second force, led by Malthorn on Dreadnought herself, and prepare to jump into San Pablo. That would form a massive fleet encompassing nearly half the capital ships in the Royal Navy. Poised at San Pablo, overlooking the smoking ruins of Rutherford's atomic bombardment, the Lord Admiral could only mean to make a deep thrust into the Hroom Empire, leaving behind a trail of wrecked planets. Why? Albion was still struggling to consolidate its gains from the last war, so there was no strategic value to gobbling up more hard-to-defend systems. It was as if Malthorn intended to deliver a death blow to the Empire. There was nothing in the message about Rutherford's meeting with Drake. Malthorn must have been steaming that Rutherford had defied him, had fought next to Blackbeard, and then let Drake and his treasonous crew go. But Rutherford had sent back so much intelligence about Apex and the new alien race's attack on the Hroom that he knew all would be forgiven if he quietly submitted to his role in the fleet. There was still a war to win, after all. With Drake gone, Rutherford was the best Captain Malthorn had left. The second message was from Drake. Rutherford had given his old friend information on how to send him a subspace if he had important news, and now Drake seemed to have it. It took a good deal of energy to send messages via subspace, and this one was especially long. There is a Hroom fleet proceeding toward Albion. It contains at least 6 sloops and intends to attack the home planet itself. You must be prepared. I am unable to give you its course because I am following a similar route and cannot risk the Navy detecting me. Forgive my lack of trust, but the Hroom were observed leaving Hades Gulch. Rutherford stopped reading and turned over this initial part of the message in his head. That answered one mystery, the destination of the alien fleet Rutherford had spotted after the encounter with the Star Leviathan. He hadn't been able to guess their intentions. The Hroom fleet wasn't powerful enough to menace Albion's home system, or so Rutherford had thought, and he hadn't been strong enough to challenge them alone. He'd passed along the sighting to the Admiralty, but otherwise continued to his rendezvous with Harbrake. Now he knew. The Hroom really did intend to attack Albion. The fools. They must be desperate. A message flashed in from Harbrake's ship, Nimitz. Rutherford glanced at it. Harbrake had detected Vigilant entering the system and was sending updated information, which Rutherford scanned even as his thoughts remained on what he'd read of Drake's subspace. 6 sloops of war wouldn't be enough to defeat Albion's orbital fortresses. Hroom sloops could orbit, bombarding the surface, but they couldn't enter a planet's atmosphere and escape again. Albion's forts would be sufficient defense. To be doubly sure, Rutherford could recommend that Malthorn leave a pair of destroyers and a few torpedo boats in place. He wouldn't even have to tell the Admiral what he'd heard, or from whom he'd heard it. A simple precautionary warning would suffice. Rutherford moved back to finish Drake's message. This is not scaremongering when I say that you must stop them. This fleet belongs to a rebel faction that worships the Hroom God of Death.
It is a death fleet, a suicide force. They do not mean to return, they mean to lay waste to the entire planet. They left Hades Gulch 63.25 hours before the sending of this message. If Malthorn will not listen, then you must face them alone, even if this means open rebellion against the fleet. In that case, send a subspace to the following systems, and I will join you in defeating this menace. I travel with allies. Captain James Drake, Starship Blackbeard, HMS Ajax. This was followed by a list of several systems where Rutherford was to send messages if he wanted to reach Drake. Presumably one of them represented Blackbeard's true location. Rutherford closed the message, encrypted it a second time, and filed it away. A suicide fleet was another matter. Rutherford most certainly would need to go back to Albion and take ships with him. He needed to catch the Hroom in open space before they entered the atmosphere on their final deadly mission. Wait, when did Drake say he'd spotted the fleet? Had he said 63.25 hours ago? Rutherford had assumed, at first glance, that Drake had seen the same Hroom fleet Rutherford had observed in Hades Gulch. It was the same size, Drake described. But that was 10 days ago, and the aliens had been jumping out of the system at the time. The Hroom wouldn't have returned, would they? There's a second fleet. It made sense. A large fleet would have a hard time passing through all those systems undetected. The Hroom must have divided their force in two. If one was caught, the other might still slip through. At least two. What if there's a third? Or a fourth? What if there were 30 sloops approaching Albion? Was that likely? A number that large would represent most of what had survived the last war. If this so-called death cult had such a force, they were more than a faction. They were practically the entire Hroom Navy. Rutherford stepped out of the war room.
"Kate, Pitsfield, you will join me in the war room at once."
Then, to distract the others, he said,
"Norris, I just received a message from the Admiralty. I'll need you to open a subspace channel to send a reply, but I don't want you wasting power, so scan for a likely spot before you do. Swayze, plot a course across the system, but don't send the data to the rest of the fleet just yet."
Cates and Pitsfield eyed him curiously as they followed him into the war room, and he shut the door. He shared Malthorn's orders first. They were to proceed across the system to rendezvous with the Admiral's flagship, and from there jump into San Pablo.
"No doubt Harbrake has received similar instructions," Rutherford said when he'd finished, "and will be expecting me to lead the fleet."
"And you don't intend to obey them, sir?"
Pitsfield asked. Rutherford didn't want to open Drake's encrypted message and leave a further trail for network specialists to track down later, so he paraphrased. As he did, he studied Cates and Pitsfield for skepticism, but saw none.
"So you want to know if we should disobey Malthorn and join Drake in this side expedition?" Pitsfield asked.
"That is not exactly my concern. I'd like to, of course, although we'd have a devil of a time explaining our actions. But Drake is missing a key piece of information."
Catherine Cates was quicker than the steady but unimaginative Pitsfield, and recognition dawned on her face.
"Did you say Drake spotted this fleet 2.5 days ago, and he just sent the subspace?"
"Yes, now you see," Rutherford said. Confusion spread across Pitsfield's face.
"I don't... Wait, do you mean there are 2 Hroom fleets?"
"At least 2, Rutherford said. "Unless the one is pursuing the other. There's a civil war in the Empire, apparently. We have to assume they're coordinating an attack on Albion."
"Are we sure we trust Drake?" Cates asked. "Could he be lying?"
"Why wouldn't we trust him? It has been established that Drake was framed for his crime, and he behaved honorably when he came to our aid during the Apex attack. Our allegiance is still to Albion, the Crown, and the Navy, but I see no reason to question Drake's integrity."
"Yes, but these allies of his you mentioned," she pressed, "they must be pirates he hired to help rescue his parents. Do we trust them? I don't think we do, and I don't think we trust anyone who would hire them, including James Drake."
Under other circumstances, Rutherford might have seen her comments as insubordinate, but it was Kate's initiative that had brought her to his attention, and he carefully considered her opinion. He was sympathetic to Drake's situation. Shortly after leaving his old friend, Rutherford had sent messages to a few trusted allies. One was his uncle, the Duke of West Mercia, who was the most powerful lord on Mercia, a cousin of the king, and by all accounts an honorable man. The Duke, who was married to Rutherford's mother's sister, was eighth in line for the throne, not far behind Admiral Malthorne himself. Rutherford asked the Duke to petition the king to pardon Baron and Lady Drake. But Rutherford could only frown at the foolishness of hiring pirates. The frontier worlds were lawless enough without putting more money, more equipment, and worst of all, more grandiose ideas into the heads of the rabble who lived there. "Yes, I see," Rutherford said at last. "Hire pirates, engage in piracy, and you become a pirate, no matter the difficult decisions that led you to that point. But I don't believe that Drake is lying so as to gain an advantage. If he were doing that, he would send us as far from Albion as possible, not draw us home."
"Assuming Drake is telling the truth," Pitsfield said, "there are two Hroom death fleets, apparently on a suicide mission. It will take a good deal of firepower to stop them, with or without Drake and his pirates."
"Our fleet is filled with dunderheads like Heartbreak and Linsel," Kate said.
"Those dunderheads are superior officers of His Majesty's Royal Navy. You will remember your place, Lieutenant."
"My apologies, sir, I misspoke."
"Yes, well, they do have their limitations, I will grant you that. I would take Drake over the lot of them. But if we can't trust his allies, where does that leave us?"
"It leaves us unable to stop the Hroom before they attack Albion," Pitsfield said. "We have no choice but to trust them. We need Drake's ships. And if there's a third fleet we haven't detected yet..."
Rutherford completed the thought. "That may still prove insufficient."
"Unless..." Cates began. "May I speak frankly, sir?"
She rubbed at the brass buttons on her jacket with one hand and tapped at the table with the other. Rutherford regretted cutting her off earlier. He didn't want to squelch her initiative. That initiative was why he had promoted her to be his second mate. Nevertheless, it wasn't in his repertoire to apologize for speaking gruffly.
"You may always speak frankly, Lieutenant. I only ask that you be circumspect with your language. We must not abandon decorum in our enthusiasm."
It all sounded stiff coming out of his mouth, like something his father would have said, but he thought it proper.
"Yes, sir. With all due respect, we must face these enemies with our full might."
"Go on," he said.
"Dread not, sir. If you were to tell the Lord Admiral, he could recall all Navy resources to Albion."
"He would demand the source of our information," Rutherford said.
"You could equivocate, sir,"
Pitsfield said. "Equivocate?" Rutherford looked at him with surprise. This was unexpected from his staid, rule-following commander.
"Yes, sir."
"I suppose I could. It is not in my nature, of course." Rutherford felt the need to add that. "But I could concoct a lie about how we captured a Hroom prisoner during this business with Apex, how he told me under duress that there was a suicidal fleet approaching, and how we have twice detected them since."
"That would keep Malthor